This is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
Crazy old man, heat's gone sour. Keep coming back again, holding on to power. Bad against the people. Got to stop. Good on the ground, rotten at the top.
Media spins leaked war plans and secret signals. Our lives are really on edge. Will we be canceled? All the while, scientists send snapshots of a planet changing too fast. That is the biggest news that will never be news. World food will crash, hurricanes will get way more powerful, plants are giving up, and nobody can keep up, but Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith keeps going. With a background in physics and climate, Beckwith is the largest pipeline of important new climate science on YouTube. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Tell us about your latest video, Paul, on the turbocharged extreme weather.
A while back, I did a video on some new World Meteorological Organization reports that came out, and I think these reports get more and more important as we get fewer reports on climate science from the U.S. So this is a European organization and reports, and one of them was on the sort of state of the climate in 2024. And the other one was kind of a supplemental report to the overall state of the climate, and it was specifically on extreme weather events that happened around the planet in 2024. And the nice thing about this report and my video is that, you know, we're just inundated with information, like way too much information. There's lots of things happening. And this report goes on a continent by continent basis, talking about extreme weather events. And, you know, even somebody like you or I who follows climate very closely will be very surprised by and not have heard of certain cyclones and typhoons and flooding events where hundreds of thousands of people lose their houses and a million people are evacuated, and we don't even know about it because it was in Africa or in South America. You know, we hear about the things in the West because we live in the West. We know what's going on in North America pretty well with Hurricanes Helene and Milton last year. You know, we know about the wildfires in L.A., but we don't know about the wildfires in Santiago, Chile, or the massive flooding. But the patterns are pretty clear. More and more places around the world are being hit by torrential rains lasting for many days, dropping, you know, up to a meter of rainfall. And that, you know, if it's on in an arid region that doesn't normally get rain, then it doesn't soak into the ground. It floods over land and you get literally up maybe, you know, up to a million people evacuated, hundreds of thousands of homes destroyed, towns destroyed. And it doesn't even make the news to us.
Related to what you just said about all these huge damaging events that happened in 2024, we can go backward in your YouTube feed to March 24th. Your headline there is, "We are heading to planetary insolvency. Climate disruption can wipe out half of global GDP by 2070. Our recent guest, Genevieve Gunther, picked up on this one too. Who says we could go broke because of climate?
Well, Timothy Lenton at the University of Exeter in the UK, they put out was one of the key authors of a report that came out with that very title, you know, Planetary Solvency, actually. And it made headlines around the world. It came out sort of towards the end of January of this year. And then it basically dropped off the radar completely in the news. So I've been doing some research on this report and on, you know, what people in the financial world, actuaries and people, insurance companies, how they evaluate risk. And the result is there's also some great peer-reviewed papers on, you know, the economic impacts of climate change. And more people in the finance industry are realizing that climate disruption could actually take out half of global GDP by 2070 if it continues unchecked. It could be higher than that, could be lower than that. You know, some economists say, well, if our economy grows substantially and, you know, people, the GDP increases like 3 times or 5 times or 7 times, and losing half wouldn't be so bad. But as Timothy Lenton cautioned in an Inside Climate interview, which is very good, you know, very, very good sort of insightful interview about Timothy Lenton and his kids and his motivations to be concerned about the future. He's, of course, he published papers on, I think one was called Tipping Points in the Climate System, you know, back over a decade ago, you know, and these were sort of key papers on how there's many tipping points in the climate system. And these are underplayed in, you know, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports. They're not discussed much at climate conferences, but they are getting more notice, certainly in areas like the insurance industry that's being hit hard now by all the extreme weather events. So this is significant. I mean, half of global GDP by 2070. I mean, that's what we're facing with climate change.
And that comes from UK actuaries, and they are not, you know, radicals by any sense of the means. They're pretty down-to-earth people, and they advise businesses, major businesses, on risk management. So we're going to have to take another look at that one.
Yeah, I mean, there's even references to sort of this idea of planetary insolvency. You can find references on the Bank of England site, for example, on the sites of the organizations that are sort of the umbrella organizations for all the actuaries in the UK. You can find them in other countries. So people are getting more and more worried about it. You know, and these are people that traditionally, you know, haven't paid any attention to climate change.
Okay, you posted another video on the same day, March 24th, and the title is Major Coastal City Risks, Alexandria, Los Angeles, San Francisco, From Sea Level Rise and Subsidence. That's based on two papers. Do you want to give us a brief picture of what's going on in Alexandria, Egypt, and then what are we worried about in San Francisco?
Well, global sea level rise is something that most people think of as, yeah, it's happening. It's happening slowly. It's not something that most people will have to worry about for many, many decades. But nothing could be further from the truth if you look at these papers that I discuss in this video, because, you know, Alexandria in particular has a very storied history. You know, it's a city that's been around for, what, 3,500 years plus. The famous Library of Alexandria was there. Cleopatra was from there. It's a coastal city, and with the sea level rise that they're experiencing now and in the past, there's a lot of salt water that's intruding into the groundwater underneath these tall buildings and ancient buildings. If there's any metal pilings underneath the buildings, they're corroding. But because the water table is brought closer to the surface by seawater intrusion, it's weakening the soils and the sands underneath the buildings. And we've had something like 280 buildings collapse in the last decade. And if you look at the collapse of buildings in the city over time, you know, it's spiking way, way up. So that's the first thing. The sea level rise is having real impacts on coastal cities at the moment. And, you know, a large majority of the population of the planet lives within short distance from coastlines. Then I did a bit more investigation, and I came upon a paper recently that was talking about sea level rise in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, and there's a lot of variation within these cities. They're large cities, but on some coastal regions of these cities, especially those that were built partly on landfill, you know, if you look at the history of the construction of buildings in these cities, they use landfill on some coast to give them more space to build. Well, there's a lot of subsidence of those regions, and in fact, if you look at the net local sea level rise in some of these regions, it's actually double what the global sea level rise would be on that coastline without the subsidence. So the land is subsiding, it's going downwards, and sea level rise, of course, is the water's rising, so the effect is actually double in some of these places And if you happen to be in a place where there's not subsidence, but the land is actually rising, it can almost cancel out sea level rise. So, in other words, you know, you can't look at the city as a whole and say you don't want to live on the coast in LA. You want to make sure you look at the specific neighborhoods and beaches and coastal communities, because you don't want to go to on one where there's huge subsidence, which on top of sea level rise will likely be causing building collapses in the near future.
Last week, I warned listeners to expect a lot more scientists and authors on this show from outside the United States, you know, due to the Trump defunding and firings and the big chill down there. Some major American universities are trying to hide their climate research under a rug. They'll just call it weather or something. I just checked the science papers behind your last seven posts on your YouTube channel. Six of the seven have lead authors or all authors from Scandinavia, the UK, or Europe. Only the paper on sea level rise in California that we just talked about has two authors from NASA, and who knows if they will still be there. What are your thoughts on NASA and the future of climate science in America?
Well, it's pretty grim, obviously, right now, and, you know, what's even worse is that this labeling of people in the U.S. as being American or being foreign nationals is having a huge negative impact on collaboration between scientists in the U.S. and scientists in other countries, because many scientists in the U.S., not only have they lost their jobs if they work for the government or NOAA or places, but those in universities that do collaboration with scientists in other countries are basically collaborating with foreign nationals, and this could cause them great problems because they've been cautioned by the government that they need to limit their collaboration with foreign nationals. So it basically destroys the ability of people, scientists in the U.S. to work with scientists in any other country in the world. You know, if this continues and gets worse and is enforced, it basically kills science in the U.S. And, you know, fortunately, people around the world are working on climate change. There's lots of very good scientists. And also, you know, I think we're going to see a large exodus of scientists from the U.S. to other countries where they can do their work, if the present situation continues. So it puts a huge damper, but I think it's only going to hurt the U.S. Maybe not in the immediate short term, but, you know, in the midterm to the long term, it hurts the country. It hurts the ability of the country to do cutting edge science, which then leads to cutting edge technology. You know, it's very backward heading, unfortunately. I look at China, you know, which has a culture of education, a culture of learning. If you look at the sheer numbers of people in the school systems that are, and people that are working in STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, in China, for example, I think there's three times as many engineers graduating each year than there is in the U.S. and, you know, in any other country in the world. So we're seeing the clean energy revolution taking off in China, originating in China with, you know, they produce 90% of the solar photovoltaic cells, which go in solar panels. They're leading in electric car battery technologies and electric cars, and like solar electrification is doubling roughly every 3 years globally, and most of that is being driven by China. They've just figured out how to charge electric car batteries in the time it takes to fill your gas tank, you know, in about 5 minutes to get a full charge that's using existing batteries with different charger technologies. So I think, the U.S., there's a grave risk that the U.S. is just how will they catch up if they hollow out their science and research? And, you know, eventually that will get to the military technology and the whole rest of it, and also the economies. I mean, if you base your economy and double up and go all in on fossil fuels now, well, the world is going to leave you behind, and you're not going to be have a viable economy at some point with that sort of action and behavior today.
Getting back to your YouTube feed, Paul, let's talk about this one, also posted on March 24th, your second in that day, and the title is Plants Reveal New Details of 10 Degree C Temperature Increase in the Big Daddy global mass extinction event 252 million years ago. Okay, I guess the question is, why do we care what happened 250 million years ago?
Well, what's interesting in this study is, of course, in that time period, the so-called Permian-Triassic mass extinction. I mean, we've had five major mass extinctions on the planet, and this was the largest of them. They call it the Big Daddy of them. And some people are arguing that right now we're undergoing the sixth mass extinction, you know, with loss of species being much higher because of climate change and the rapid changes now. So, you know, maybe we can learn some lessons by studying previous extinctions to avoid avoid another one. If you look at the fossil record of the plants at the time before and after this extinction event, there's quite a huge difference in the plants. Like, they can look at the fossils and see what plants grew in a certain area, and we know how continental drift has changed the surface of the Earth. So we had one huge supercontinent at that time called Pangaea, and we can see the different types of vegetation stretching from the equator to the poles on this one continent, which stretched from the equator to the poles, and we can see how the vegetation changed significantly and how, you know, the isotopic signatures and stuff say that, well, yeah, the temperature increased, the global average temperature increased 10 degrees Celsius during that event, so hopefully we can learn more about it. But it's very applicable today, for example, with climate change, with temperature patterns changing, precipitation patterns changing. You know, many areas that are breadbaskets of the world today for growing food, you know, the staple crops, the wheat, maize or corn, rice, other grains, you know, as climate shifts, these areas shift. And most of the world will be able to grow less food, with the exception of Canada, northern areas in Canada, northern areas in Siberia and Russia. But then we need decent soils, so it will take time for those soils to develop. Yeah, I mean, agriculture globally will shift, and it'll become much harder to grow food to feed the growing population. So we can learn about the present day from what happened in the deep past.
For more on that food, you can check out Paul's video posted March 18th. It's titled Global Food Quantity and Diversity to Drop by More Than Half with Our Accelerated Climate Warming. And this is all based on science, folks. That article was published in Nature. He's not making it up.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Next one up, Paul, I kind of touched on, and I've got more coming on this, but it's titled Tropical Cyclone Hurricanes Strengthen Energy to Undergo Jaw-Dropping Increases Over the Next 5 Years. We've suspected that would be the case, but now we know more.
Yeah, it's next 5 years, next few decades anyway, for sure. You know, the ocean's absorbing 90% of the heat. So when we talk about global warming, it's really, you know, mostly ocean warming. And then with warmer oceans, you get warmer atmosphere, and the greenhouse gases, you know, trapping the heat and so on. Any temperatures, ocean sea surface temperatures above 26.5 degrees means that you get amplification of these storms. And the other big factor that's equally important is we're getting a reduction of shear wind. So when you have a large tropical storm moving up the scale to eventually become Category 5 hurricanes, they call them cyclones in other parts of the world and typhoons in other parts of the world, there's about 68 of these storms per year globally. You know, we mostly think of the North Atlantic Basin and the hurricanes that come form sort of off Africa, come through the Caribbean, hit the U.S. Those are the ones that we tend to focus on, but there's many others in other basins. These storms need to organize to go up the scale and become superstorms, if you like, Category 5. But if you have shear winds, in other words, if the wind is blowing in different directions at different altitudes, then that works against organization of the storm. if you have very, very high shear, high altitude winds in different directions from low altitude wind, that can basically chop the top off these developing cyclones and limit their strength. What we're finding is that the shear is actually reducing significantly with climate change, and that combined with the warmer ocean temperatures means that we're getting more of these storms forming, and when they form, more of them are making their way up to Category 5 type storms. So this is like a double negative whammy for humans that live along the coastlines or even inland. I mean, we saw, you know, Hurricane Helene to cause huge billions and billions, I think something like 58, almost 60 billion worth of damages, and it caused huge inland flooding because it filled the rivers, which then took out towns and so on. So the damages were extensive inland from storms. So these, you know, I think James Hansen calls them superstorms of our grandchildren when he wrote that book a decade ago, and they're happening today, it turns out.
Yeah, I hope to speak with the lead author of that cyclone paper, Paul Arthur Monnery. Maybe that'll come out next week. We'll see. He's from the National Center for Atmospheric Science at the University of Reading. Let's get to another paper where you and I intersect. Last week, I interviewed Australian super scientist Pep Cannadel about plants losing their ability to carbon capture, and you covered an earlier important paper and posted the video, Simple CO2 Keeling Curve Math Show Earth's Carbon Sinks Peaking Already in 2008 and Now Declining. Help us understand why this is such a frightening development for all of us.
If you look at the Keeling Curve, the famous Keeling Curve data collected on Mauna Loa in Hawaii since 1958, you know, it shows basically during the Northern Hemisphere winter, there's not plants growing, you know, it's colder, so the CO2 levels are higher, and then in the spring, they start to drop significantly as we reach Northern Hemisphere summer and the plants all come alive. And then it brings you down to a minimum within the year, and then as you move into the winter and the leaves fall off the deciduous trees, the CO2 level starts to curve up. So there's a seasonal cycle, and that drop from the maximum CO2 in a given year to the minimum is about 7 parts per million or so, but that peaked in 2008. It was increasing up to about 2008, the drop, and now it's declining. And it can only mean that the carbon sinks in the Northern Hemisphere are reducing. And this is very concerning because, you know, a lot of carbon is taken up on the land, but it's also taken up in the oceans. And with ocean stratification, there's less vertical mixing in the ocean, so there's fewer pathways for carbon to go from the ocean surface down to deeper levels where it's sequestered. So this is a huge, basically the massive carbon sinks that soak up tremendous amounts of the CO2 that humans emit are reducing in strength. So the CO2 in the atmosphere is increasing. And then everything cascades, you know, the greenhouse gas effect is more powerful, warming is more powerful, you get more stratification of the oceans, more stresses on vegetation that's growing on the surface, and the CO2 levels then continue to rise up at record rates, which is what we're seeing. So this is very, very concerning, and it's very simple math. You just look at the curve, you know, and average the curve every year and see, you know, how it's changing over time, and you can see that those sinks are declining. So it's a very elegant paper in its simplicity.
It is. We are running out of time, of course, well before we run out of breaking science. We left out scientists finding very large pools of frozen methane in the seas around Antarctica. You make videos about the climate emergency with Dr. Peter Carter, and Carter says so far that Antarctic methane is dissolving into the seas. It's not quite reaching the atmosphere. It's not affecting the climate yet. And then the Arctic sea ice, which you've been following for decades, I guess the maximum has now passed. Was it a record low again, Paul? What's the situation there?
the sea ice globally is at basically pushing along record lows. So, you know, the Arctic's been sort of declining steadily over the years. Of course, if the ocean currents, the AMOC, shuts off, then that will reverse in the Arctic. You know, I've talked about a blue ocean event where we have less than 1 million square kilometers. So that happens, the minimum occurs in September. So, you know, now we've just passed the peak volume and area extent of sea ice in the Arctic, that's at record lows. So that doesn't bode well for this melt season. Meanwhile, in Antarctica, up until about 2010, 2015, we had an increase of about 1.5% in the extent of sea ice around Antarctica per decade, for many decades, and then that reversed, and the sea ice in Antarctica has basically dropped off a cliff since then, and so it's pushing along at record lows. It just reached its minimum when the Arctic reaches its maximum. Of course, the poles are out of sync in terms of, you know, winter in one, summer in the other pole. So we reached the maximum in the Arctic and the minimum in Antarctica. And if you add the ice extents from both together, you get basically record low global amounts of sea ice. So this is only accelerating climate change because it means that the, you know, less sea ice, the darker ocean underneath is exposed. And basically the reflectivity or the albedo of the whole region decreases with less sea ice. So there's more solar absorption and more heating, and you get this, and then back leading back to less ice, et cetera. So there's all of these nonlinear feedbacks or tipping points or cascades in the climate system, as we know.
Paul Beckwith taught climate science at two Canadian universities, and he takes you along with his journey with his teaching videos now on YouTube at Paul H. Beckwith. Just search for that on YouTube, Paul H. Beckwith, and you're going to find a lot. Find links to all the videos and science that we just talked about in my weekly show blog. It's published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you for spending time with us again, Paul.
Thank you, Alex. And as a last thing, I should let people know, if they like my sayings, like connecting the dots on abrupt climate system change or what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, they can now go to my son set up an online store called Paul Beckwith Store, and you can get, you know, a T-shirt or a baseball cap with my favorite climate sayings on them. So just thought I'd give a little plug, or my son will be upset with me.
All right, we've got it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Here is a new song from Radio EcoShock. As usual, my lyrics are set to music by AI. Anyone can use this song or parts of it for any non-commercial purpose. Pass it on. Rotten at the top.
What do I hear? Echoes in the heat. 100,000 people talking with their feet.